Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I'm producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill, we're recording on Tuesday morning. So someone sent me a hilarious comment by David Sedaris. Some of the words I can't say because they're a little too edgy, but it's about the idea of the choices that we have in November of 2024. And here's how he described it. I think of being on an airplane. The flight attendant comes down the aisle with her food cart and eventually parks it beside my seat. And she says, can I interest you in the chicken? Or would you prefer the platter of crap with bits of broken glass in it? To be undecided in this election is to pause for a moment and then ask, so just tell me exactly how is the chicken cooked? I love it. Can I interest you in the chicken? Or would you prefer the platter of you know what with bits of broken glass in it? David Sedaris knows how to nail it. It's exactly what the problem is, everyone. And as I was thinking about that, I'm going to sort of do a segue to my first guest because I posted something on Facebook this morning because I woke up so upset about what's going on in Gaza, so upset about the famine, so upset about the murder, so upset about how students of Jewish faith or Islamic faith feel uncomfortable and frightened living on college campuses. And I'm going, oh my God, Bibi, what are you doing to the world? What are you doing to us? And before I introduce Congressman Khanna, I wrote the following. I wrote, Bibi is a corrupt leader using the killing and starvation in Gaza, not to protect Israel, but to save his own political future. To dislike Bibi is not to hate or dislike Israel any more than to hate Trump if he gets elected for a second term, is to hate or dislike America. This is not rocket science. This is common sense. Bad leaders need to be called out. To defend them is to be complicit. Joining me right now is Congressman Ro Khanna. So, Ro, I was looking through something and I realized you ran for Congress three times. I didn't realize that you would run in 2004, then you ran again, I guess, in 2014 that time, and then you ran again for a third time. I honor you for that because I think I told you that I had Bella Abzug's office when I was a fellow at Harvard after having lost my race for Congress. And I used her quote as sort of the theme of my time at Harvard. And it was, you have to lose, lose, lose to win. And obviously you have gotten that because you do that incredibly successfully. So let me remind everyone, Congressman Ro Khanna is a representative from California. He was born in Philadelphia on September 13th, 1976. He went to the University of Chicago. He also has a JD from Yale University. He was a deputy assistant secretary in the United States Department of Commerce through 2009 through 2011. He finally got elected to Congress in the 17th congressional district, and he is now a congressman located in the heart of Silicon Valley. And I want to welcome you back to the program and thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Arnie, it's great to be back on. I appreciate your mentioning the losses because what happens is the further you get in your political career or some success, people omit all the failures. And the reality is actually the campaign I'm proudest of is my first one. I was 27 years old. It was a three-month campaign. I was opposed to the Iraq War and to the Overbroad Patriot Act. And it was the first anti-war Iraq war challenge in a primary in the country. I lost 71 to 19, but that was pure idealism.
Well, actually, it's interesting. I do want to talk about your loss because I give speeches to a lot of people who are interested in thinking about politics or political leadership. And I remind them that most of the people that are interested in politics will lose, that most of those people in that room will not win. That's not a reason not to run, okay? You may not win, but that's not a reason not to run. And that sometimes by running and losing, you're actually setting it up for the next generation. You may be opening a door for someone else, even though you may not get to walk through the door. And as just one quick aside, I was watching an interview with Debbie Stabenow the other day because she's going to be retiring for the U.S. Senate. And what you don't know about Debbie and Arnie, let me tell you this. In 1996, the Democratic Party picked six Democrats in the United States that if they won their race for Congress, would change Congress and America. Debbie Stabenow and I were two of the six, okay? That was 1996. Debbie won, Arnie lost. And now how many years later, almost 30 years later, Senator Stabenow is now retiring. And I was listening to her talk and I was going back to that year in 1996 when the two of us were brought down to Washington to be shown off as, you know, the potential best and brightest in that class. And I regret having lost, but I will be honest with you also, Ro, I met my second husband in the year 2000. If I had won that election, I never would have met him, and I never would have been loved. So sometimes losing also opens other doors, not just doors for winning, but doors for meeting people. So anyway, I just thought I'd let you know that I don't mind talking about loss because I'm in that camp.
Well, Arnie, and I think you had have had such an incredible impact on policy and ideas in New Hampshire. And, you know, Debbie Stabenow's had an impact, but now she's retiring. And it reminds me of two things very briefly. You know, John F. Kennedy once said that when he was in the House, he thought, wow, you couldn't do anything in the House, one out of 435 people, if only he could get to the Senate. And then he got to the Senate, he said, well, you can't really do anything as one out of 100 people, if only he could get to the White House. And then he got to the White House and he said, wow, you can't really do anything as president. All the power is with Congress. As a collective, it's all in Congress. And I remember Obama, some of his speeches where he would say, I can't do anything. And I would feel so frustrated. But the reality is, even if you reach the president of the United States, you're just an individual. And change requires every person in this country in different ways. And the distinction between someone who's in elected office or not pales in significance to the social movements that really bring change. And the question is just what role we're going to play in that movement. And that's why you run, because it's a voice to add your voice to history, in edging history in the right direction.
Absolutely. That's why I keep telling people that in a lot of ways, by the social movements, you give people the opportunity to then go to Congress and actually make the change. But without that sort of moat of that social movement around them, they can't do it in isolation. You can't be a leader without a follower. You know, and that we sort of need each other in so many ways. But I was listening this morning on MSNBC, and they were talking about how many students on college campuses feel afraid for the first time, in part because of their faith, whether they're Jews or whether they're Muslims. And we know that what's happening right now in Israel is causing a rift everywhere. I feel like we're walking on broken glass. We can't talk about it. And I started, before I introduced you, with my comment about Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump. And that I feel totally legitimate in criticizing both leaders, because I think they're both making horrific mistakes. And they're not only hurting their nation, they're hurting the world in so many ways. And to a large extent, I just feel like if I don't talk about it, then I'm being complicit. You have spoken a lot about what's happening right now between Gaza, Hamas, and Israel. And you have spoken about the need for a ceasefire. Let's talk a little bit about what we need to do to make the president of the United States, who clearly understands how difficult the situation is, but that he's not helping Israel by basically not demanding something more than, you know, saying, I want you to come to the United States with your military folks so we can talk about this discussion about what you're going to be doing going farther into Gaza. I just feel like we have to take a moral stance, because Bibi is not. And I am grateful that you're willing to speak up, but how do we move the president?
Well, I think we need to speak with moral conviction, because this president, I do believe, is a deeply moral and principled person in public life. The reality is, look, I have been a strong supporter of the U.S.-Israel relationship in my 8 years in Congress. I have Jewish nieces in my own family through my brother's marriage. I've been to Israel 2 times. I condemned unequivocally the brutal, horrendous attack on October 7th, and been very clear that the UN findings say that there were rapes and there was sexual violence, and that needs to be acknowledged. And we have to understand the trauma that this represented for Israel and for the Jewish people around the country and around the world. I had an anti-Semitism town hall yesterday in my district where people were talking about being harassed in school and on college campuses and not being able to give their last name. But then we say, well, as a democracy, and Benjamin Netanyahu calls Israel the sister democracy to the United States, there have to be certain principles, higher principles than just saying, well, we're not Hamas. And when you have something like yesterday, where Benjamin Netanyahu is denying the head of UNRWA access into Gaza, basically saying he can't come The United States would never do that. We would never say to UNRWA, because you were criticizing us, the UN criticizes us all the time, that you can't come on our soil when 2 million Palestinians are facing potential famine, and UNRWA is the one agency that distributes food. So this is where the president can find his voice. And, you know, the United States president matters. When the president said, you will let in the UNRWA head, Netanyahu is not going to just defy that. If the president is very clear and says, okay, we have to have the release of all the Hamas hostages, but then the violence needs to end, because until the violence ends, we can't get food in, we can't get water in, and that has to take precedence. And I believe that the president has to come out as a statesman for his second term and say, I'm going to be the person with all my experience that gets peace done. I'm going to go and have a Gulf state summit with Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel there too, and new Palestinian leadership, and recognize a Palestinian state and move towards two states. And this is the vision that I have. And that's actually, in my view, what will demolish or get rid of Hamas, because Hamas is just an ideology that armed resistance is the way to end occupation, and there needs to be an alternative.
Well, and to a large extent, Bibi agrees with Hamas. I mean, they both want to go from the river to the sea. I mean, if you actually, I mean, they bet both of them don't want the two-state solution. So to a large extent, in order to get to that two-state solution, you have to sort of understand that both of them are, in some ways, they're working in tandem. And what's in tandem is bad for the Palestinians and bad for the Israelis. It doesn't offer them safety and security. And one of the things I thought was so interesting is that, you know, Joe Biden suddenly realized after 9/11, we made a mistake. It should have not been a military operation. It should have been more of a police operation. But instead, we went to war and we went to war. And what did we accomplish? And what you are seeing now is, to a large extent, I feel like a replay of our mistake after 9/11. And Joe Biden realizes that. He's even sort of said that. So to a large extent, and then when you hear Bibi get so upset because of what Chuck Schumer said, calling for an election, I wrote something else down that I heard Jonathan Martin say. He said, it's hard for Bibi to make that "how dare you intervene in our democracy" case when Bibi Netanyahu spends more time on U.S. TV than on Israeli TV. And that's so true, Ro. I mean, both everybody wants to have influence over another election. The question is, what is the morality of the moment and what does the moment demand? And I am really afraid, because what Bibi is doing is not only, I think, damaging to Israel, he is damaging to the future of our democracy, Ro. It is not just about Israel. It is about the election of November 2024. There are going to be so many people that won't necessarily exercise a third option, but they won't show up. And you saw that in Michigan, and people saying, well, that's because there are so many Muslims in Michigan. That's not true. I know too many progressives that are feeling the same way. And it's not because it has a religion identification. It's because they're looking at the morality of the moment and they're going, what are you doing? And that's what frightens me, is what Bibi is setting up for November of 2024. And that's something we cannot accept.
I agree. Now, look, we have to make the case, and I try to make the case as a surrogate for the president, that that American democracy is never just one issue, and that there's a multiplicity of issues. It's a abortion rights, it's gun violence, it's climate, it's working class wages, it's labor, it's Ukraine, and even with the Middle East, it's someone who at least is committed to a two-state solution versus Donald Trump, who we know didn't really care about Palestinians. He wanted the Abraham Accords, which I supported, but with no recognition of a Palestinian interest. So the choice it has to be, in my view, clearly to rally around the president, but then to be firm with the president and in a change of course. And, you know, the proof of this is someone was joking. They said, I don't understand it, bro. You're hitting the president on cable news one night saying that he needs to have a change of course. And next night they're sending you out to campaign for him. Aren't they going to put you on the bench? And I said, no, I think it's a testament to this president that he wants people who disagree with him on areas still saying that you can vote for him. And I think what I am trying to do is to create a permission structure to say, this is a president who will listen. You can criticize him. You can be angry with him on certain issues. You can be frustrated. But at the end of the team, we have to be a coalition to have him win and not get Donald Trump back in the White House.
And there is no human being I agree with 100% of the time. And so I just, I mean, I totally, and that's not what you elect a person for. You don't elect a person because they mirror everything you think. You can't find someone like that. And frankly, you shouldn't find someone like that. Because in the end, you and I both know that there is going to be kind of even a compromise sometimes with yourself as you decide what is so important as you look at this election. And obviously, as someone who's so concerned about the overturning of Roe, I am apoplectic about what could happen in 2024. But I saw something interesting because we know that President Biden is now sort of taking the dog and pony show and going on the road. And his new issue du jour is he's frustrated that people aren't recognizing his economic success. And there's no question he has been wildly successful on a lot of macroeconomic issues. But when it comes to how people live their lives, they don't live their lives in the macro. They live their lives in the micro. And what does that mean? That means, can they find an affordable place to live? Can they find their childcare that they can afford? Can they afford the food on their plate? And as much as you can applaud someone for what they're doing on that macro perspective, I think Biden is suddenly realizing that the reason why he is not necessarily resonating with a lot of the American people is that they're finding that their everyday lives are getting more and more financially challenging. And so what we're seeing is that now he's got this big push now to talk about housing. And I thought it was interesting because what they said was Biden has made cutting consumer costs a central element of his economic case for reelection. And what we see he's rolling out is his focus on housing. Ro, you've been aware of this for a long time because about a year ago, you also focused on something that is part of the economic case for a re-election. And the consumer cost that you focused on was childcare. And I think what I hear it over and over again, and not just from women, but from employers. The whole idea is you can either increase someone's wage or you can make it possible for them to find an affordable place to live or put their kid into a daycare setting that they can both afford and they can still afford to go to work as their kid is being protected. There are so many ways to take a bite at this apple. And I think you talked about daycare. How do we get the president to understand that is so central to both business as well as to families?
Well, I think you put it so well, Arnie, in terms of the empathy we need for folks who can't afford the American dream. I mean, they can't afford to have the life that their parents had. I was talking to someone in LA the other day who was a successful television studio executive, and he said he went back to his 50-year reunion in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he said every single high school friend of his had done worse than their parents comparatively, and their kids are doing worse than even them. And so, you know, the president, someone had said to me, is building cathedrals. The president has a great plan of what America needs to do to lead in the industries of the future, to lead in infrastructure, to start to bring back manufacturing. But on the day-to-day, people's rents are too high, their childcare costs are too high, their college costs are too high. And, you know, I said to the White House, stop just talking about junk fees, because, you know, when you say, OK, we're going to eliminate junk fees, people are saying that's not taking care of the $1,000 a month I'm paying on childcare. That's not taking care of the bills that I have on health care. So, yeah, it's great. You gave me a $50 or $100 credit on my junk fees. And that's sort of Clintonian politics of the 1990s. And I respect President Clinton. But, you know, we're living in big times. We need big solutions, not just small solutions. And so childcare is at the heart of that. And what I proposed is childcare, $10 a day. That's still $300 a month. You know, I was with a family in my district, $25,000 they're paying for childcare for three kids, $25,000 a year. That's insane. And if we could do $300 a month for every family and you pay childcare workers $20 an hour so that those are good jobs that are taking care of kids at the most important ages, that would be transformative. And then people say, well, can it get done? I would say, have the president campaign on where he wants to go. Where does he want to take America? Yes. And lay out a few clear things of what he's going to fight for. And that childcare should be one of those big buckets that he fights for.
You were talking about the American dream. Many years ago when I was at a conference at Harvard, there were a group of women from all over the world. And the question was asked of these women, what would you want more of? Would you want more time or more money? Now, listen to this. The women, the European women asked for more time and the American women asked for more money. And everyone was like, oh, that's terrible. And I said, no, it's not. Because the European women have universal health care. The European women have basically free college. The European women have access to free or reduced daycare. So what do they want? They don't need money. They want the time to spend with their family. In America, we have to cut the check for daycare. We have to cut the check for university. We have to cut the check for being, and I'm like, don't you understand? It's not that they're oriented towards more money. They're oriented in making sure that their families are safe, that they're fed, that they have a house to live in. And in so many European countries, you don't have to question whether you should go to a doctor when you're sick because they have universal health care. And I think that idea of the American dream, if that's something that somehow Joe Biden can talk about, and you're right, he is building cathedrals, but he has to look at the people that walk into that cathedral and say, are they walking in hungry? Are they walking in without a safe place to live? And if they don't, then we really aren't addressing what it is that we need, because it's a gestalt that we have to look at. I don't know, Ro.
It really isn't. It's about the sense of anxiety in this country. I mean, it's, you know, when I was growing up in the 1980s, as a, I was sharing this experience at this anti-Semitism town hall where one of this young Jewish American kids talked about being harassed in 10th grade. I said, I grew up Indian American of Hindu faith in the 1980s in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, where it was 95% white Christian. And I grew up so hopeful about America. There were incidents here and there of being teased, but my formative experience was you could achieve anything in this country. And that's the sentiment that we're losing in this country. It's really sad to me that the sense that the American dream is out of reach, that you can't go and buy a house, that you can't get education without going into massive debt, that you can't get childcare, that we're going to be in perpetual cultural conflict and you will be harassed for who you are or bullied for who you are. And I think that's why the 4% unemployment, just reciting those statistics, doesn't speak to the anxiety that Americans are feeling at this time. And I think what the president needs to do is to dig deep, because he's such an empathetic person, and to remember the anxieties that his parents grew up with, and to see that the country is hurting, the country is anxious, and to empathize with that, and then to say, here's how we start to get out of that, and here are the things I'm going to do to improve your life so that the American dream is still possible. And that to me, getting that tone right is more important than the recitation of his accomplishments.
And I hear him say, we have the strongest economy in the world, the strongest economy in the world. And you've heard me say this to you before, Congressman Khanna. And that is, what is an economy for? If the success is Wall Street, if the success is CEOs, if the success is stockholders, if the success isn't for the rest of us, then saying we have a strong economy that hasn't filtered into the everyday living lives of people where they can find a place to live. I told you, I had a little one bedroom, like a room in my house with a single bed. And I normally rent to law students, and I put it up on Craigslist because I had a student that left in the middle of the year. And a family of three applied to live in this room with a single bed. That's it. And I'm like, excuse me, this is just a little bedroom with a single bed, because it was the only thing they could afford. It was the only thing they could afford. And those are the stories we have to have with us as we talk about the future.
And it's not just the stories, Arnie, it's actual statistics. When the president says it's the strongest economy in the world, the one thing I would gently push back with is, you know, Mr. President, we are ranked 128th when it comes to wealth and income inequality. You know what China's ranked? 77. You know what Great Britain and Canada and other European countries are ranked? They're in the 30s and the 40s. We're 128th. We can't be 128th in terms of income and wealth inequality and say we're the greatest economy. And we didn't used to be 128th. This has exploded in the last 30 to 40 years. So that's why people are not feeling the prosperity and the economic numbers. And, you are helping build things that are going to make America's economy strong, but we haven't done enough to tackle that inequality. dealing with increasing minimum wage, dealing with childcare, making sure rents don't go up higher than inflation. These are the kinds of tangible things that you should be fighting for, that we should be fighting for, because you're right that Donald Trump's not going to do anything. I mean, we'll probably go from 128 to 150, literally, if he's president. But how do we get that number down? How do we get back into the 30s and 40s?
And that's why Congressman Ro Khanna is such a good surrogate for Joe Biden, for exactly what you just said. If it is Wednesday, it is the Attitude with Arnie Arnison, and I want to thank Congressman Ro Khanna for joining us. He represents the California 17th Congressional District, located in the heart of Silicon Valley. You can join me anytime, Ro. Thank you so much.
Always an honor. Always a pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you,
Arnie. You're welcome. Ciao. This is the Wednesday edition. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute.
Bernie Moreno has won the Ohio Republican Senate primary and will face Sherrod Brown, the incumbent Democratic senator, in November in what will likely be one of the most hotly contested and certainly one of the most important Senate races in the country this year. Moreno was not originally a particularly strong candidate, didn't have the best resume of the candidates in the race on the Republican side. He won the primary because Donald Trump endorsed him. It's not a surprise. A few years ago, J.D. Vance, the other senator from Ohio, won his primary, came from behind because Donald Trump endorsed him. And the reason I say this is, one, to stress how important Donald Trump is in the Republican Party, but to go even further with that. The punditry and the media still try to describe the Republican Party as having a Trump faction and a non-Trump faction. You know, the Trump faction and the Haley faction. The truth is, for a practical perspective, there's only one faction in the Republican Party, and that's the Trump faction. It's not so much that Trump represents the majority of the Republican Party. Trump and MAGA are the Republican Party, and that's why people like Bernie Moreno, who in fact may be weaker general election candidates, are consistently winning Republican primaries. That's why Nikki Haley, despite the media excitement around her, never really became a serious candidate and is now all but forgotten.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of the Attitude with Arnie Arnison, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. We spent a lot of time hanging out in Iowa. Well, maybe it's because my ex-husband's family is from Iowa. My daughter went to the University of Iowa. I used to hang out with Stefan Schmidt, who did Iowa politics on Iowa Public Radio. But I'm always interested in Iowa, one, because historically they used to be the first in the nation presidential caucus. And yet at the same time, whenever I think about sort of the three states that are sort of defining what is the MAGA moment, it is Texas, Florida, and lucky you, Laura Bellin, it's Iowa. Laura Bellin is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for Bleeding Heartland, a community website focused on Iowa politics. She is also the statehouse reporter for KHOI Radio in Ames and co-hosts the station's Capital Week program, as well as a member of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. I want to welcome you back to the program, Laura. Thank you so much for not only following what's going on in Iowa, but giving us so much sort of like these copious notes of what is going on. We keep lamenting the loss of investigative journalism and knowing really what's happening both in our towns and our cities, let alone in our state houses. And clearly you have a passion for all things Iowa and you've giving us so much information. And I'm grateful that you're willing to join us and explain to the rest of the country what's happening in your state. So thank you for doing this.
Thanks so much, Arnie. And I just love the state government and state legislative coverage. That's really my passion more than presidential campaigns.
Oh, I totally get it. But I was thinking about what's happening now because of Dobbs and the overturning of Roe and how Republicans are suddenly realizing this is what happens when the dog catches the bus. It's like all of a sudden, everything that you thought that you were sort of going to be beating the drum for would never become a reality. And now you have to live with the reality. And the reality turns out to have enormous, enormous blowbacks. And we're seeing it where, whether we're looking at referendums in Kansas, we're looking at what happened on so many of elections, we're looking at what's going to be going on in the 2024 election, where this whole idea of women's bodily autonomy is going to be so important. And as I mentioned to you just before you came on the air, what's been so interesting about the discussion about abortion is that historically, a lot of women didn't talk about abortion. Yet we know that maybe even as many as one in four, maybe even higher numbers have had an abortion over the course of their lifetime. And so now we're hearing from women all over the country talking about their experience after a rape, talking about their experience, you know, having two children and realizing they couldn't afford to have a third, talking about, you know, they got pregnant when they were 17 and they realized that they had a baby, they would never be able to go to college and eventually have a family and do whatever. And so now these stories are tumbling out, Laura, in such an amazing way. And we're realizing how it touched and changed so many, not just women's lives, but families' lives. And it reminds me of something I did many, many years ago. I was invited down to Massachusetts to give an award out to sort of the top five females in Massachusetts who were notorious because they were the tops in education, in the legal issues, in corporate America, and they were to be honored at this event. And so I'm in the green room, and there are the five of them, and then there's me. And we start shooting the, you know, the breeze. And it turned out to be something very, very interesting. Of the six women in that green room, five of us had been on welfare, Laura. Five of the six. The only woman who was not on welfare was L.D. Acheson, Dean Acheson's daughter, who's going to be recognized that day. And I remember going out to this, you know, this group of very well-heeled 1,000 women that had just paid hundreds of dollars for the ticket and saying, let me tell you what the six of us have in common, at least five of the six. And then I mentioned that five of the six of us had been on welfare. And that it turned out that it wasn't that we were on the perpetual government teat, but that we needed someone to help us as we tried to figure out how to sort of segue into the next step in our lives. And now look at how successful these women were, all right? And then I look at the whole story about abortion. And to a large extent, it is about women's bodily autonomy, but it is about them being able to pursue a dream or having the family they want or recognizing that they could not carry a child as a result of incest or rape. And that it was so much more than making these decisions. And you just wrote an amazing piece at Bleeding Heartland about what the Republicans are trying to do now that they're realizing that they have this concept of personhood, you know, that when a sperm and an egg gets together, immediately we describe it as a baby. Well, that's going to be a problem if that personhood implies a petri dish and a sperm and an egg. And what am I referring to? But I'm referring to IVF. So explain to my audience, how the Republicans are trying to figure out how to thread this needle, because whatever they're attempting to do doesn't allow them to be consistent. What they claim is their belief in when is a child, because if you've got to value a Petri dish, but not value what happens in the womb, they got a problem.
They do. I want to, before I get to your question, I just want to say that people sharing their abortion stories, it really is tremendously important. And the anti-choice movement has weaponized the stories of a small percentage of women who regret having abortions. And I empathize with them. I'm sorry that they made choices that didn't work out for them. But it's so important for people to talk about, the vast majority of people who have abortions do not regret the choice. And for them to talk about that this allowed them to pursue an education or to leave an abusive relationship or whatever their reasons were. And
exactly.
I admire the people who are sharing those stories. And I think that that's helping to change minds. But now let's get back to Iowa here. We are in a strange limbo state in Iowa because the legislature passed last year a near total abortion ban, but it is not in effect. The courts have enjoined it. And right now the state's appeal is pending with the Iowa Supreme Court, but they haven't heard arguments yet. So we don't know yet whether the Iowa Supreme Court is going to let the state enforce this near total ban. So right now, I think a lot of Iowans don't feel that anything has changed because abortion is still legal here up to 20 weeks. So they're trying to, in the legislative session that's going on right now, the Republicans are trying to undermine abortion in all kinds of different ways without passing another direct ban because they already did that. So this is one of the bills that we're about to talk about that the Iowa House approved. It looks like it's not going to move forward in the Senate, but there is an existing crime on the books in Iowa for non-consensual termination of a human pregnancy. That means causing a miscarriage or some grievous harm to the fetus. And the Iowa House Republicans approved a bill that would change the wording. It enhances the criminal penalties for the various stages of these crimes, whether it was intentional or unintentional and so on. And then it changes everywhere throughout the code. Instead of terminates a human pregnancy, it changes that to causes the death of an unborn person. And then later in the bill, unborn person is defined as an individual organism of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization to live birth. So when this was debated in the House, a number of Democrats raised the obvious issue based on what just happened in Alabama. And in fact, one of them, Heather Mattson, used the IVF process herself to have her twins and was talking about how if you are going to say that causing the death of an unborn person, and that could be a fertilized egg, is a crime in the state of Iowa, IVF is not going to be available. And Republicans just dismissed this argument and ran the bill through the House. But it seems that the Senate Republicans in Iowa are afraid to move this bill for that reason.
So you mentioned one of the things I think that's so, I mean, it's almost like they're numb to what they write. And I don't know how they could distinguish between what they wrote about personhood and what happened in Alabama. I mean, I don't even know, how do they argue it with a straight face? But what's going on between the House and the Senate in Iowa? I mean, you have this trifecta of Republicans. You've got the governor, you've got the House, you've got the Senate. And historically, they seem to be working, you know, in tandem together. But it appears that finally, maybe in 2024, there's going to be like even a slightly bit of a line of demarcation between what the House rushes through, whether they think it through or not. And then all of the sudden it's going, well, maybe not. And I'm just trying to figure out, how did that happen? Or are they beginning to realize that the consequences of passing these bills could ultimately hurt the Republican Party, not just whether this bill actually becomes a law?
Well, it's so obvious, especially after what just happened in Alabama. It should have been obvious to everybody. And I don't know why the floor manager in the House and most of the House Republicans who voted for this bill, I don't know why they didn't see the obvious problem. What he said during the debate was that Iowa code already has a definition of unborn child that covers fertilization to live birth. The difference is that Republicans included that in 2017 when they passed our 20-week abortion ban, the one that's still in effect. And that did define unborn child from fertilization to live birth. But it was in relation to what doctors have to do before they perform an abortion. So that we're clearly talking about a pregnancy gestating in that context. When you change it to a criminal context, and then you say death of an unborn, causing the death of an unborn person, and that could be a fertilized egg in a petri dish, obviously that has implications for IVF. The 2017 code section does not relate to IVF. It clearly relates to somebody seeking an abortion. So that is what I think there was a real disconnect. But what I found incredible, and we're now in the eighth year of a Republican trifecta, and they have done a lot of damage to the state of Iowa. They have passed a lot of sweeping bills in a lot of areas of life. But it's kind of odd this year, the Iowa House and Senate Republicans, for whatever reason, they are not seeing eye to eye on a lot of issues. That last week was an important legislative deadline in Iowa, and the two chambers killed a lot of each other's bills. I mean, they each had a bad immigration bill that then died in committee in the other chamber. They each had bad education bills that died in committee in the other chamber. And so this is one of those casualties from last week. And what the Republican senators said, who didn't advance this bill, was that they were concerned about the implications for IVF. And the Senate Majority Leader said that he thought the bill wasn't ready for prime time. And, you know, it made me laugh because before Dobbs, you know, before any of this happened, the Iowa Senate approved a bill in 2019, almost exactly the same word. I looked at the text side by side. There are just a handful of words that are different, and there's one section that's in a different placement, but it is basically the same bill that every Iowa Senate Republican voted for 5 years ago. Of course, they weren't thinking that anything like Dobbs would happen, and they weren't thinking about the implications for IVF. So 5 years ago, the Senate passed this unborn person bill that then died in House committee. So, and now it's the other way around. So I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm glad, frankly, that they don't work better together, because there are just a lot of terrible ideas, some of them relating to state government. I mean, some of them relating to healthcare. There are a lot of bad things that died in the other chamber. And I don't know, there may be some horse trading that happens near the end of our session, and some of these ideas could come back to life. But I think that this personhood bill, I think the Senate is going to be too scared to move forward with this based on what's happened in Alabama.
So there was a piece of legislation, I guess, I'm not sure it passed, but it may have died. The idea of supporting pregnant women, that the men that have impregnated these women now have an obligation to support these pregnant women during their pregnancy. Explain to me a little bit about what the sort of thought process was and why a lot of people are like, I'm not sure this is a good idea either. So, you know, I mean, I like the idea of being supportive. I really do. I think you should. I mean, actions have consequences, and you should be responsible. But explain to me a little bit about this piece of legislation, because I thought it was interesting to hear both sides argue.
This was a really interesting legislative debate. It's something that rarely happens in Iowa. Usually, once they bring a bill to the floor, they've already decided, I mean, the fix is in, basically. The votes are there, and they're going to pass it. But so this was a bill, it was presented as a child support bill. And the idea was that we're going to help women, especially single mothers, who have so much burden to carry, and we're going to make sure that the men who father their children are on the hook to help them cover some of these pregnancy expenses and birth-related expenses. That was the stated goal of the bill. But several Democrats, and we have a first-term House Democrat here, Dr. Megan Srinivas, who is not an OBGYN, but she's a doctor. She's very knowledgeable, and she really does her research, and she talked to a lot of OBGYNs about this bill and was prepared for the debate, which the Republican floor manager was not prepared for the debate.
Oh, but no. Keep going.
And several of the lawyers who were in the Iowa House Democratic Caucus pointed out that the way this bill was worded, a man could, and it maybe he is the father, or maybe he's not the father, maybe he's an abusive partner, maybe he's an ex, he could go to court under this bill and demand a paternity test in utero and say, hey, I want to be involved with this. I'm the father. I think I'm the father. And I wanted a paternity test so I can be involved right away. And of course, a paternity test after the baby is born is not invasive. They just swab the cheek. But the way the methods, and Megan Srinivas described in detail on the House floor, this is what they would have to do. And of course, an OBGYN would never recommend some of those invasive, risky tests just for the purposes of a paternity test. But under this bill, potentially a man could go to court and try to get an order demanding that to happen. And she said every OBGYN she showed this bill to was concerned. And in the middle of this back and forth, and there were several Democrats spoke on the bill, and in the middle of all of this, the House Majority Leader suddenly stood up and said, we're going to defer on this bill, not putting it to a vote. And
it, well, and isn't it, that's great.
It is great. Yes, it's great. I mean, I don't know what his goal was. I think that they literally didn't understand the wording of what the way I assume that this particular bill was well-intentioned, but I also think that it was yet another way for Republican legislators in Iowa to try to elevate the status of unborn persons. And, you know, to make someone, it wasn't exactly child support, but it was presented as a child support bill. So we're going to make men pay child support before the birth was the concept. But that one's not going anywhere. It is on the shelf.
But it shows over and over again that they don't know how to play it out, that they don't do their homework. They do something because they think it sounds good. But then in reality, when you play it out, it's awful, which is why they pulled it from the floor. I mean, it's just incredible. It's so like,
that doesn't even, maybe once a year and not even every year does something like that happen, that in the middle of a debate, it just gets derailed to the point that they pull the bill.
Well, to a large extent, I compliment him on pulling it. At the same time, it just shows the fact that this is shoddy policy. This is not being done because people are informed. It's not being done because they, I mean, when you write a piece of legislation, you want to bring in as much information to the table before you actually commit it to writing. You want to play it out in every way, shape, or form, and they don't care. This is all about grabbing a headline, seeing, look at how fair we are. We're going to help support the woman while she's pregnant because we're getting all this blowback about the fact that the woman is responsible. And we're going to say, no, now the male's responsible. But they never played out what ultimately that would mean.
Well, and there are one bill that I didn't talk about in this most recent post, but I'm probably going to write about later, is that this is part of the governor's plan and that the Senate has approved it. The House hasn't acted on it yet to fund safe, get make it easier for the state to fund these crisis pregnancy centers. You know, this is how they pretend they're supporting pregnant women. You get a few, maybe a free car seat and a few diapers or something, like as if that is going to compensate someone for raising a child they don't want, or, you know, going through with a pregnancy that could be very disruptive to their life. But in any case, it was another example, that debate in the Iowa Senate was just another example of Republicans not understanding all the implications of their bill. There was language in the bill that talked about privacy, but the problem is that laws like HIPAA, those apply to healthcare facilities, but these crisis pregnancy centers are not medical clinics. And so they would not be bound by patient privacy or other ethical stance. And so the Democrats offered an amendment to try to make sure that any pregnancy centers that received funding through the state program would be subject to these other, the same type of laws and rules that apply to healthcare facilities. And of course, Republicans voted down that amendment.
Unbelievable. So let's talk a little bit about education in Iowa, because we know that you have this expansive voucher bill. And I'm looking at, and I don't know what an AEA is, but I'm looking at a headline, Iowa superintendents sound alarm about AEA changes. And then I see a discussion about special education. So hold my hand and explain this to me, Laura.
This is like the surprise, enormous issue that is dominating the 2024 Iowa legislative session. I would say 3 months ago, I'd be surprised if even 10% of Iowans knew what area education agencies are. This is a system that was created in the 1970s. Actually, our current Senator Chuck Grassley, at the time, was a member of the Iowa House. He was one of the key architects of this AEA system. It was soon after the federal government passed the first version of the law that's now called the IDEA that guarantees a free, appropriate public education to people with disabilities. And the concern was that Iowa had a lot of small rural school districts that were never going to be able to offer the services that people needed. And so in the 70s, they created this system. It used to have 15 regional AEAs. It's now down to 9. There's been some consolidation. But an AEA basically has an economy of scale. It covers a large region covering a lot of counties and school districts, and they provide all kinds of services, including equipment. They do also birth to three diagnostic and occupational therapy. They do speech therapy. They help people get assistive devices that they need. They help sometimes with science curriculum. And because they have this economy of scale, they could, if suddenly a small rural school district has a child who's hard of hearing or is blind, the AEA can step in and provide those services. And so the federal special education funds, they go directly to the AEAs in Iowa. That's the way the system works. So school districts get all these services. It's not a fee for service based thing. It's like what the school districts need, they get from the AEAs. And they also do things like professional development, media services. They do crisis management. So if there's suicide in a school, or we just had this horrific school shooting in Perry, Iowa in January, the AEA staff were on the ground within about an hour and a half of the school shooting. They help counsel people in those situations. So they really provide a lot of services. And for reasons no one has really explained properly, our governor, Kim Reynolds, decided last year that she just wanted to completely scrap the AEA structure and centralize power over special education in her administration and the State Department of Education. Why she wanted to do this, I'm not sure. She commissioned an out-of-state consultant's report to say that special education in Iowa is terrible and the system needs to be changed. These people who compiled the report didn't consult with any Iowa stakeholders. Really, nobody was the school, the superintendents, the AEAs, the people on the ground, the parents of special needs kids were not involved. And so the governor dropped this bill on the legislature, similar to how she did with the school vouchers last year. And she clearly expected it to be rubber stamped the same way the Republicans rubber stamped her school voucher plan last year. In fact, I mean, she dropped the bill in January, and the next day, the State Department of Education was already posting about 30 job listings for this new division of special education that the legislature hadn't even authorized yet.
Oh my God. I've
never seen anything like that. So, but there was so much pushback from special needs families, from teachers, from educators, from superintendents, that the House and the Senate, they both kind of put the brakes on this. So what is the state of play now is the House Republicans passed a bill that is, it's still a bad bill, but it's way scaled back from the governor's plan to just basically destroy the AEA structure. The Senate just yesterday, they passed a version of the bill that is much closer to what the governor wants to do. It basically converts special education to a fee-for-service process. School districts would get the money and they would decide whether to use the AEA or not. And the problem with this is some larger school districts, ones with wealthier tax bases, they could take their money elsewhere and purchase the services. And then the problem is the small rural school districts, those AEA services might not be available if the bigger school districts aren't paying in. Right now, it's like a safety net. The AEAs are like a safety net. And the Democrats have been saying, why are we doing this? There's no justification for doing this. The AEAs, we could, at most, we should have a task force that brings in all stakeholders to look at, are there improvements that we could make to the system? But it's been phenomenal. And some of the legislators who have been there a very long time said they've never gotten so many emails on an issue. And they got a lot of emails last year on school vouchers. But this is different because school vouchers was like an abstract threat to public education in Iowa. But if you are a parent of a child who has benefited from services through the AEA, this is like a direct threat to your family. And the legislators have received thousands of communications overwhelmingly against what the governor wants to do with the AEA. So this is a drama that's ongoing because right now, I mean, the Senate approved a bill. The House Republicans, they only had 53 votes. They need 51 for majority. They only had 53 votes for their bill, which was way scaled back. So I don't know that what the Senate just passed could actually get through the House. But the governor is really determined to get something done on this. Nobody knows why. And so we'll see. But it seems like this could be one of the key issues that holds up the closure of the legislative session. And by the way, the other thing that's all wrapped up in this is that the legislature, by Iowa law, should have already passed a school funding bill by early February that stipulated how much state funding the school districts were going to receive for the coming academic year. They still haven't done that because it's all held up while they're working on this AEA thing. And school districts are supposed to be working on their budgets that are going to need to be certified next month. And they still don't even know how much state funding they're going to receive for the coming year.
You know, as I'm listening to you, there's a theme here with Governor Reynolds, and it's a war on rural communities. Because if you look at what's going on with the whole voucher and the idea that it's going to undermine public education and public schools, when you look at the AEA, you were just talking about, you know, who would benefit. The rich school districts could do the contracting out, but then the money wouldn't be going into the AEA. Once again, poor rural communities who get shafted, they do. And it's ironic because it's those rural communities that prop up Republicans. They keep Republicans in power. And yet, if you look at what Governor Reynolds is doing over and over again, she's undermining their ability to survive and thrive, Laura. I don't get it. What
is it? I don't get
it.
I do not get it. And as I mentioned, when this system was created 50 years ago, it was a Republican trifecta in 1974. And specifically, it was for the benefit of these small rural school districts. Everybody understood that. Chuck Grassley understood that. that this AEA system was going to create economies of scale. And I had a guest author who's a parent of a child with a very rare genetic disorder. And she talked about all of the things that the AEA did for her family, even when her daughter was an infant and they were living in a trailer and they didn't even have a permanent home. The AEA was there providing services. And if she had had to wait to get on the Medicaid waiver, that could have taken years. I mean, they didn't even have a definite diagnosis. So nobody really understands what is the governor's deal with this. Why is this a priority? It certainly will hurt rural school districts. The handful of superintendents who have spoken out in favor of the plan represent pretty well-off areas with a strong property tax base. But as I published on my website yesterday, a group of more than 30 superintendents signed this public statement that they emailed to all 150 state legislators on Sunday evening to say, please don't do this, that this is a grave threat to the students we serve. And so I don't know, it seems like the governor still is insistent on allowing schools to opt out of the AEA and also limiting the kinds of services that the AEA could provide. So nobody has been able to explain, for instance, who's going to provide these crisis services if the AEAs are not doing that? What's going to happen when there's the next school shooting or when there's a suicide or when a student dies tragically in an accident? Right now, we have the AEAs, they send grief counselors to these school districts that are affected by that. But it's not clear whether that can continue. So this issue, like I said, months ago, very few people were plugged into the AEAs, but it has become such a hot button issue in Iowa this year.
I hate to bring it to you, Laura, but I want an AEA in my state. I've never heard of the concept, but it is so powerful because, again, it understands that, you know, you're bringing together, you know, wealthy communities, poor communities, rural communities, urban communities. And there's that gestalt that you bring together in these AEAs means that you can then provide the services in a reasonable, rational way that's also affordable for all these communities. And it was like such a great idea. And for her to suddenly want to sort of dismantle it, as I'm looking at it, it would be destabilizing our educational ecosystem. Well, it sounds like that's her whole agenda, is destabilizing the educational ecosystem.
I have no idea. And they cherry picked some data to make it look like the AEAs are not doing well with special education. But that's not what the stakeholders do not feel that way. The superintendents overwhelmingly do not feel that way. And the special needs parents, let me tell you, those people are making their voices heard. And I think that's why the bill wasn't rubber stamped by the Republicans.
Well, I need to let you go. Laura Bellin is the publisher, editor, and primary reporter for Bleeding Heartland. How lucky is Iowa to have you covering the State House? That's all I have to say. Your attention to detail is remarkable. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude. Arnie Arneson produces, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll show you tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You Change.